And so that's why Iran was willing to give away its nuclear capabilities in return for economic incentives. But if we want to get a deal with Iran on missiles and on regional policies, they only come in return for security assurances that I think there's very little appetite for in the US or in the West.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Franz Ocilia, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Leo Kamen. Today on the podcast, we'll be covering the ongoing negotiations between Iran and the United States on a new Iran nuclear deal. What did the original Iran deal, the JCPOA, entail? Why did the Trump administration withdraw the United States from the agreement? And what would a new nuclear deal with Iran look like through all these years and many tribulations? To answer these questions and more, myself and Leo are joined by Ali Vaez. Mr. Vaez is the Crisis Group's Iran Project Director and Senior Advisor to the President. He led Crisis Group's efforts in helping to bridge the gaps between Iran and the P5 plus one that led to the landmark 2015 nuclear deal. Previously, he served as Senior Political Affairs Officer at the United Nations Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs and was the Iran Project Director at the Federation of American Scientists. We're very excited for this conversation and hope that you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Vaez.
Great pleasure.
Before delving into the negotiations that are currently occurring between the West and Iran and the other countries involved, I would like us to begin by starting by giving a little context to our listeners. So to that end, could you please describe to our listeners what the original Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action entailed and what its purpose was and who were the main actors at the time?
Sure. Look, it was revealed in 2003 that Iran had a secret nuclear program. And since that time, there's been efforts, both diplomatic and coercive, to try to contain and roll back Iran's nuclear program. Most of these efforts failed from 2003 to 2013, mostly because both sides were pursuing very different agendas. Iran wanted to maintain its nuclear program, and the West, and primarily the United States, wanted Iran to have zero nuclear capabilities that would provide Iran with an option of eventually developing nuclear weapons, because we're talking about dual-use technologies here. But finally, in 2013, after years of tensions and a very dangerous nuclear standoff, and after a very damaging race of sanctions against centrifuges, we finally had an interim agreement, which is known as the Joint Plan of Action, which basically froze Iran's nuclear program in return for some partial sanctions relief. That deal was achieved between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. That's US, Russia, UK, France, and China, plus Germany. So it's the group that known as P5 plus one. But it was really the product of secret negotiations between Iran and the US that started in Oman in 2012. After the interim agreement, the parties spent another 2 years negotiating a more comprehensive agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, which was concluded on July 14, 2015, and was implemented on January 16, 2016. What it did is that it basically, the core bargain boils down to Iran rolling back its nuclear program and putting it under very rigorous international monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, or UN Nuclear Watchdog, in return for sanctions relief and economic incentives. That's really the core of the JCPOA. In practice, it meant Iran basically shipped out 97% of the stockpile of its enriched uranium. It dismantled half of the centrifuges that it had installed, about 10,000 centrifuges that were running at the time. It poured concrete into the core of its heavy water reactor that could produce enough plutonium for a nuclear weapon every single year. And again, it accepted the kind of monitoring that was really unprecedented. Iran has 1/10 of the number of nuclear facilities that Japan has, but had more inspections than Japan is currently under. In return, it received about 750 delisting of Iranian entities and individuals that were sanctioned by the U.S. It received sanctions relief also from the European Union, and the six UN Security Council resolutions that had passed to condemn Iran's nuclear program and impose international sanctions on Iran were also replaced by a new UN Security Council resolution, 2231, which enshrined the new nuclear deal.
And as the JCPOA was being finalized in 2015 and implemented towards the end of 2016, what were the primary criticisms coming from the U.S. Congress and also America's allies in the region? Why were these parties unhappy with the deal?
So, look, I would put the critics into two different categories. First are critics that had some problems with the merits of the agreement. And that is either because, in their view, some of the nuclear measures were not strong enough. For instance, there is a requirement in the JCPOA that if Iran does not allow access to a site that is not declared to the IAEA, there is a 24-day process of a dispute resolution that would require Iran eventually allow access to UN inspectors, or it would face the UN Security Council. And critics said that that period is too long, allows Iran to basically make disappear any traces of nuclear material, which is completely misguided, because traces of nuclear material cannot be discarded with just washing away evidence. They usually have a lifetime of several thousand years, if not millennia, and it's not easy in 24 days or 24 years or 24 centuries to get rid of them. So, or there were people who were unhappy primarily about the sunsets in the JCPOA, which is about the fact that some of the limits in the nuclear deal fade away after several years. But there is not one sunset in the JCPOA. There are several. For instance, some of the limits on Iran's advanced nuclear, some of the limits on Iran's advanced centrifuges disappear after 10 years, or the UN Security Council resolution disappears after 10 years. But some other limits, like limits on the level of enrichment or on the size of the stockpile, which are the most important limits to make sure that Iran would not have enough nuclear material to be able to dash towards nuclear weapons, they disappear after 15 years. And then there are some other measures that would remain in place for 25 years or permanently. For instance, there is a requirement that Iran ratifies the additional protocol, which gives enhanced access to IAEA inspectors. And if that happens, it's basically a permanent monitoring mechanism under which there is no way Iran would be able to develop nuclear weapons without detection. So that's one category of critics. But by definition, the JCPOA was a compromise, so it obviously was not perfect, and there was always room to try to build a follow-on agreement on top of it. In the same category of critics on the merits of the deal were those who said, good news, we have a nuclear deal, but bad news, we only have a nuclear deal because it doesn't really address other disagreements with Iran, like Iran's ballistic missiles program or Iran's nuclear activities, et cetera. The reality is that the Obama administration made a deliberate decision only to focus on the most urgent issue, which was Iran's nuclear program, because it realized that tackling all of these disagreements with Iran at once is just simply not realistic and possible. Look, as I said, it took 2.5 years to negotiate just the nuclear deal. Now, imagine if everything else was on the table. Plus, there is a key issue here that most people in Washington do not understand. And that's the fact that, unlike the nuclear program, which for Iran was not core to its national security, Iran's ballistic missiles and its support for partners and proxies in the region are critical to its national security. And so that's why Iran was willing to give away its nuclear capabilities in return for economic incentives. But if we want to get a deal with Iran on missiles and on regional policies, they only come in return for security assurances that I think there's very little appetite for in the U.S. or in the West. So those are the first category that I want to talk about. The second are those who, you know, have an ideological opposition to the political order that exists in Iran, to the Iranian theocracy. And for them, basically, no deal is better than any deal. They don't want a deal that would benefit the regime, because in their view, it would extend its lifetime. Or in the short run, it would provide it with more resources to project more power in the region. And so for them, I always say, you know, what's really concerning is Iranian enrichment and not uranium enrichment. And in that category, you know, there's no deal that would ever satisfy them unless it's basically a declaration of complete surrender and capitulation from the Iranians. And this is, by the way, the policy that the Trump administration pursued by withdrawing from the JCPOA in 2018, reimposing not just those 750 sanctions that were lifted under the Obama administration, but imposed an additional 750 new designations and layered designations on top of that. But it didn't achieve a better deal. In fact, it made everything worse. Iran's nuclear program now is closer to the verge of nuclear weaponization than it has ever been. It has become more aggressive in the region and more repressive at home. So, you know, and we are...
Mr. Weiss.
Go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Weiss, what I wanted to follow up on, actually, was the decision by the Trump administration in May 2018 to pull out of the deal. Could you expand a little bit more about why the Trump administration made the decision to leave the JCPOA?
Look, President Trump had basically campaigned on the promise of tearing apart the nuclear deal, like all other Republican candidates. And, you know, when the JCPOA was reviewed by Congress in 2015, there was not a single Republican who voted in favor of it. So this has become an extremely polarizing and partisan issue in the United States. But when President Trump took office, his key security and foreign policy advisors knew the risks of withdrawing from the deal that would basically unleash Iran's nuclear program. When President Trump walked into the Oval Office, the key metric in the JCPOA, which is the breakout time, which is the amount of time that it takes to enrich enough fissile material for a single nuclear weapons, was more than 12 months. This is a timeline that the JCPOA extended from about 3 months in 2015 to 12 months. Right now, as we speak, that breakout time is about 10 days. And I think that is what President Trump, Secretary of Defense, and the First Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, they were all concerned about. So they found a way of trying to delay that damaging decision until 2018, so about a year and a half into Trump's presidency. And at that point, he replaced his national security team and brought to power people who were in the category of ideological opponents of Iran that I explained to you, people who have been seeking regime change in Iran for many years, and so saw the nuclear deal standing in their way and struck it down by withdrawing in May of 2018. Then U.S. sanctions came back into effect in two main batches, one in August of 2018 and another one in November of 2018. And from that point on, the Trump administration pursued a policy known as maximum pressure, aimed at reaching 12 specific strategic objectives with regards to Iran, some of them related to its nuclear program, again, in pursuit of some maximalist demands that the Bush administration and Obama in his first term had also pursued, but also to try to roll back and curb Iran's ballistic missiles and regional activities, as well as eventually human rights violations as well.
It's been almost exactly 4 years since the Trump administration pulled out of the JCPOA. You alluded to this some in your previous answers with comments about the decrease in breakout time. What has transpired since our pullout with regards to Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Crisis Group, the organization I work for and is an advocate of the JCPOA because we're in the business of preventing conflict, and we believe that this nuclear deal achieved that objective. Was one of the first pro-deal organizations that came out in January of 2017 when President Trump was being inaugurated and argued for a better for better agreement to be built on top of the JCPOA. Because we argued that it's impossible to erect a stronger deal on the ruins of the original agreement. Because if you withdraw from the agreement, you would basically signal to the Iranians that the U.S. is not a reliable negotiating partner. So first of all, you make negotiating a future nuclear deal that much more difficult. This is also what allies in Europe and the rest of the P5 plus one wanted. They wanted the U.S. to engage in follow-on negotiations and not to withdraw from the original agreement. So the U.S. was completely isolated on this. So in terms of the consequences, of course, the Trump administration took Iran's nuclear program by withdrawing out of the box that it was in and put it in the microwave. Iran waited for about a year after Trump withdrew from the agreement in the hope that the Europeans would be able to compensate Iran for the effects of Trump's withdrawal and reimposition of sanctions. But the Europeans failed to do so despite their very strong political support for the agreement. Simply because European companies who have a lot of stake in the U.S. economy and want to preserve access to the U.S. financial system did not really want to risk their ties with the U.S. only to do business with Iran. And so once it became clear to the Iranian government that the Europeans are not going to be able to support Iran, they started to gradually breach their own nuclear commitments. By the time that President Trump was leaving office, Iran's breakout time had shrunk from about 12 months, more than 12 months, to about 6 months. What happened is that in November of 2020, right after the elections, when it became clear that President Trump had lost the elections, there was an assassination of a top Iranian nuclear scientist, allegedly by Israel. What that did was it pushed the Iranian parliament to adopt a legislation that mandated a rapid expansion of Iran's nuclear program. Iran started enriching uranium to 20%, which is the level that it was enriching to prior to the JCPOA in January, right before President Biden was inaugurated. Then in April of 2021, there was another sabotage at an Iranian nuclear facility, again attributed to Israel. And that pushed Iran to retaliate by enriching to 60%. Now, 60%, it's important to understand, is just a stone throw away from weapons-grade uranium, because enrichment is not a linear process. It's harder to enrich from 5% to 20% than it is from 20% to 60%, than it is from 60% to 90%, which is considered weapons-grade. 60% is basically 99% of the effort that takes to enrich uranium to weapons-grade. And Iran now has sufficient quantity of that material to make a nuclear weapon with in a very short period of time. In parallel, Iran also developed much more advanced centrifuges that, based on the JCPOA, it was not allowed to do so until 2026. And so, we are now facing a really dangerous situation in which, as I said, the breakout time is a matter of days. And by this June, it probably will fall into what Biden administration officials call the margin of error. That is a 4 or 5 day window, which basically means that because now we also have much less inspections of Iran's nuclear facilities, between two inspections of the same site, the Iranians might be able to break out without detection. So that is a very dangerous and intolerable situation from the perspective of Israel, who lives in the region and feels threatened by Iran. And of course, even from our perspective, it's a very dangerous situation. And take into account that some of these, the damage that has been done as a result of the U.S. Unleashing Iran's nuclear program is not reversible, because this is knowledge that has been gained by Iranian nuclear scientists. And you can't, wash that away or wish it away from the mind of those scientists, who now know how to operate advanced centrifuges that they were not supposed to be able to do for years to come. And so this is the net result of the maximum pressure policy.
I'm wondering from your answer how exactly the other parties to the JCPOA reacted to our withdrawal. And I'm also wondering how Iran's influence in the region has changed, both since the signing of the JCPOA and since our withdrawal.
So U.S. allies in Europe who were partners in the JCPOA negotiations really tried hard to prevent the U.S. from withdrawing from the agreement. There was a flurry of diplomatic activities in early 2018 to try to keep the U.S. in compliance with the JCPOA. In fact, the E3, France, UK, and Germany, they started negotiating with the Trump administration elements of a follow-on agreement, and they were pretty close to the finish line when President Trump all of a sudden pulled the plug on these negotiations and decided to exit the agreement. They, in the aftermath of U.S. withdrawal, not only they condemned it, they tried to find a way of keeping Iran in compliance. For the first time, Europe created a mechanism that was designed to basically go around U.S. sanctions. And this is a really watershed moment, because we're not talking about Russia and China trying to skirt and circumvent U.S. sanctions. We're talking about European allies, who had until that point always tried to coordinate their sanctions with the U.S., trying to develop a banking mechanism that is immune to U.S. sanctions, known as INSTEX. Now, in practice, that mechanism really didn't work well and didn't throw a lifeline to Iran, but it is a sign of how frustrated Europe was. Another example of how this act made the U.S. Isolated on the international scene was when in 2020, based on the JCPOA's calendar, the UN arms embargo on Iran was about to expire. This is related to conventional arms, and it was agreed that 5 years after the deal's implementation, it would expire. The Trump administration tried everything in its power to prevent this embargo from coming off. It failed. Then it tried to snap back the UN sanctions, which is the right of all JCPOA participants. But because President Trump had ended U.S. participation in the JCPOA 2 years prior to that, basically the entire Security Council sided against the U.S. and prevented the Trump administration from being able to move forward with the snapback. So that was a net result in terms of how the U.S. created a rupture between both sides of the Atlantic. Now, U.S. allies in the region who were concerned when the JCPOA was signed that this is basically a blank check to Iran to expand its activities in the region were initially very happy that the Trump administration withdrew from the deal and started putting pressure on Iran. But when Iran decided that it's time to start pushing back and retaliating against maximum pressure policy, basically they are the ones who pay the price for it. There was, if you remember, in May of 2019, a major attack in the port of Fujairah in the UAE targeting tankers. Then there was a series of attacks on tankers in the Sea of Oman and through the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. And there was, of course, a spectacular attack in Saudi Aramco oil facilities that took off half of Saudi oil exports from the market overnight. Now, in parallel, of course, we saw an increase in tensions between Iran and the U.S. in 2019. Iran and the U.S. came to the verge of military confrontation three times, once after the U.S. shot down once after Iran shot down a U.S. drone, second time after the attack on Saudi Aramco, and then a third time after the U.S. Killed Iran's top military commander, General Soleimani, and Iran retaliated by firing ballistic missiles into U.S. military bases in Iraq. And, you know, since the U.S. withdrew from the agreement, according to the Biden administration, the attacks on U.S. Military personnel in the region has increased by 400%, whereas the period prior to that, when the JCPOA was being negotiated and then implemented, there was not a single attack on U.S. forces in the region by Iran or Iranian-backed allies. You see that, again, this is, although it was, technically speaking, separated from the nuclear issue was separated from the regional dynamics, but without any doubt there was a spillover effect of withdrawal from the JCPOA into regional tensions, and that is why I'm saying it made everything worse. It did not. The idea was that if Iran does not have enough resources to advance its regional policy, it will be forced to moderate its behavior in the region. It did the exact opposite. And there is no evidence in these years that Iran has reduced its support for proxies like Hezbollah or Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. In fact, Israeli military intelligence officials believe that Iran has increased its support for those groups. That's why maximum pressure was really an abject failure across the board.
Mr. Vaz, when... In January 2021, President Biden came into office and he pretty strongly signaled that he wanted the United States to rejoin the JCPOA or sign a new nuclear agreement with Iran. As the negotiations of the agreement are transpiring at the moment, what do you see are each side's goals for the new agreement, and what are Washington and Tehran looking for this time, and how would it differ from the original JCPOA?
President Biden ran on the promise of restoring the JCPOA and then building a stronger and longer nuclear deal on top of that. But when he came to office, he initially dithered and hesitated and failed to take any action that would basically signal to the Iranians that he has abandoned maximum pressure policy of his predecessor. That pushed the Iranians to toughen their position. It created a difficult atmosphere for negotiating a mutual return to compliance. Those talks started in April of 2021. Indirectly, the Iranians even refused to talk to the U.S. because their idea was if we wanted to talk to the enforcers of maximum pressure, we would have talked to the Trump administration. And in practice, the Biden administration has done nothing to signal that it is now pursuing a different strategy. With a lot of ups and downs, both sides came pretty close to a roadmap on how to get back to the original agreement by June of 2021. But then Iran had a presidential election, and the more pragmatic government of Hassan Rouhani gave its place to a much more hardline government of Ibrahim Raisi in Iran. And that basically created a... that basically pushed the Iranians to adopt an even tougher approach towards the negotiations. It took them 5 months to return to the negotiating table. In that period, of course, their nuclear program was making rapid advancements. And when they came back to the table, they were even more intransigent than before. But nevertheless, both sides were able to overcome a lot of their remaining differences and got to a 27-page detailed agreement that would take Iran and the U.S. back into full compliance with the JCPOA. By March of 2022, that text was almost ready when the Russians created an obstacle. And that obstacle was that Russia, which now, after having invaded Ukraine, was the subject of Western sanctions, was trying to take the JCPOA hostage in order to punch a hole in the Western sanctions regime and wanted waivers to be able to engage in all sorts of trade, banking, weapon sales to Iran with immunity. And of course, that was not acceptable to the West. This pushed the negotiators to put the talks on pause. And although the Russian obstacle was resolved, about a week later, Iranians went to Moscow and convinced the Russians to walk back those demands. But momentum was already lost. And in this period, it became clear, as it was leaked to the media, that the last remaining obstacle in the negotiations is a non-nuclear sanction that the Trump administration put in place in April of 2019. And that's the designation of Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a foreign terrorist organization. Now, this was a controversial decision even in 2019 because FTO is designed to target non-state actors. And Iran's Revolutionary Guards is a branch of Iran's military. And of course, the U.S. sees this as a non-nuclear sanction because it's related to Iran's regional policies and the fact that Iran, according to U.S. intelligence, is now seeking to assassinate Trump administration officials, both civilian and military, who were involved in planning and executing of Soleimani's killing in January of 2020. And of course, both of those issues, both Iran's regional policies and these plots, are highly concerning to the Biden administration. So it was not going to offer an unconditional lifting of FTO unless Iran was either willing to commit to engage in regional negotiations or to drop these plots against Americans, both in the region and on U.S. soil. But since this became public, it made it much more difficult for both sides to show flexibility on this issue. And now the talks have been on pause as a result of agreement over this non-nuclear issue for nearly 2 months.
After these talks have been put on pause and we've reached this point in the negotiations, what would need to happen for both sides to come to an agreement? Are you confident that the U.S., Iran, and the other parties involved will be able to finalize an agreement? And what would that look like?
So what it takes is political courage from both sides, especially because the alternatives to an agreement are really much less attractive to both sides. For the U.S., the alternative to a deal is an unrestrained Iranian nuclear program that would put the U.S. in front of a unpalatable choice in a matter of weeks, which is either to decide to live with an Iran that is basically a virtual nuclear weapon state, that Iran would have the capability to develop nuclear weapons and would be, a very short distance away from crossing the Rubicon and actually developing that capability. Or to try to prevent it militarily, which means another U.S. military intervention in that part of the world, which has always ended in grief. For Iran, lack of a deal means living under U.S. sanctions for the foreseeable future. And although the Iranian economy has survived, it is still in very difficult waters. Inflation is at historic heights. Unemployment remains a very chronic issue. Especially now as a result of hikes in food prices, as a result of the Ukraine war, the food prices are really reaching a level that is very difficult for the Iranian people to tolerate. And plus, survival is not the same thing as being able to thrive, which Iran cannot do unless it comes out from under U.S. sanctions. So, let me say that this situation, I don't think, is sustainable in the sense that, as I said, in the month of June, when the IAEA new report comes out about Iran's nuclear advancements, this is a quarterly report of the agency, it probably will become clear that Iran, that the breakout time has become even shorter and might be already in that margin of error zone. Plus, Iran and the IAEA have a lot of other outstanding issues and disagreements that were supposed to be resolved by June, because the nuclear deal was supposed to be revived by June. Now, in the absence of the JCPOA's restoration, I don't see Iran be willing to cooperate with the IAEA, which probably means during the Board of Governors meeting of the agency in June, they would have to issue a censure resolution against Iran. And Iran has threatened if that happens, it would retaliate by ratcheting up its nuclear program even more and ratcheting down its inspections. And so if all of that comes together, already in this summer, we will be in a situation that the specter of war will be once again showing itself and putting the entire region at risk. What it takes to get out of this situation, I think, is a reasonable compromise around the issue of FTO, which is for the U.S. to delist the IRGC as a whole, which, again, was never supposed to happen and is a sanction that has utterly failed in achieving its objective of curbing Iran's regional activities. But then to redesignate the Quds Force of the IRGC, which is the expeditionary force of the Revolutionary Guards that actually operates outside of Iran's borders. So when the U.S. refers to acts of terrorism, these are acts that do not happen within Iran's borders. They're happening in the region by Iranian-backed allies, mostly, that are affiliated and supported by the Quds Force. So this would allow the Biden administration to say it kept the sanctions where it mattered, although, again, from my perspective, those sanctions are completely useless. And by the way, the IRGC, even without the FTO, remains one of the most sanctioned entities in the world, and the U.S. has still numerous other sanctions targeting the IRGC. In my view, it makes no difference whatsoever. But the Iranians could also say that they managed to delist the IRGC and they don't care if the Quds Force is under sanctions. And the IRGC has a role in Iran's economy, so maybe some of the IRGC's entities would not be under sanctions. Although, again, I think this is also immaterial to Iran, because with or without FTO, the IRGC will remain radioactive for international and multinational firms. But this is the kind of compromise that works in diplomacy, that neither side really gets what it wants, but has enough to be able to say that it got what it needed. And I think that would allow the deal to be finalized and implemented, because it's still the least costly option compared to all the other alternatives. Now, if that is not possible, I think the only other option is to get an interim agreement similar to the JPOA, which would just freeze the cycle of escalation between the two sides. Because otherwise, you know, we have seen this movie before. It's very clear what's going to happen. Iran would ratchet up its nuclear program. The U.S. would ratchet up its sanctions. And we get closer and closer to the verge of a disastrous military confrontation that could easily turn into a regional conflagration.
And with that, Mr. Baez, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at HopkinsPOFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.